Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we kind of move forward, it is about the Constitution. We are trying to help everybody understand by this content what and why we need to do this. And as a matter of fact, we're going to be starting all over again and diving into the history of what our forefathers did. It all starts January 1st. Or actually, hold it, January 2nd, because January 1st we'll be covering how to set effective goals. We've done this before, and we will probably do this on both New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. For those of you who've never learned or you want to help people understand, you know, how to set goals and how to obtain goals, I think that's effective. And it's important, and it's an effective process if you have a plan. If you lay it out and you set up a plan and you execute the plan, you have a better chance of succeeding. So anyway, welcome back, Sean.
Be here, sir.
And so we want to continue to provide the content so that as we pray, learn, and act, that we are learn, pray, act, they can be more effective in our efforts. In addition to this, I want to help everybody emphasize that we need to start supporting these politicians who are committed to the Constitution. These aren't just aimless campaigns. The very little money that these guys usually get, and it's unfortunate, it's not enough. If you think that you're giving too much, you're not. If you have the ability to give more, and that's what I mean by that. and helping and working with other people who have ran races, they've never come close to what it costs them to do the race. So in other words, there's a lot of personal investment. And if we're not willing to support people who are actually taking a stand and actually asking you to hold them accountable, hold the, you know, their constituents and have the people hold them accountable to their oath, if that's what you want, then we need to start showing that America is willing to actually start backing and supporting these folks. So don't hesitate. Get up, get your contributions going into Gerald's campaign. If you don't know how to get to his campaign, you just come to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the candidate's endorsement page. That's where you can find how to give a generous contribution to Gerald so that he can have money to do the traveling and doing the things he needs to do to be successful. Anyway, all that being said, as I look at where we are in the content and as I kind of, you know, go through what we have left for the year, well, shoot, next week's Christmas. Next week's Christmas. So on Christmas, we will actually cover Christmas Eve and Christmas. We're going to cover the why we celebrate Christmas the way we do. Because this is my annual message of the forces that were involved in changing behavior within America, which actually became a successful endeavor, and it became more and more successful as more and more people got involved in helping, I'll just say, manipulate the American people, where they ended up deploying. I mean, Christmas has become a very lucrative opportunity for, you know, for lots of people, lots of businesses and corporations, because they've taken it worldwide. And so we see lots of people that really, and nations that have had no history other than this is what we do in America. Anywho, so we'll cover that next week. We'll also have some shows, and again, like I said, the setting the effective goals. So we've got maybe, well, other than today, 5 more days of content. 5 more days until the end of the year. So we have that much time to cover what Madison is going to expose to us in his report. And that's where we left off in our last show yesterday. We were covering Madison's report. We just ended with paragraph 23. And this is where Madison began helping the legislators once again. There's no doubt in my mind he got into the details with these guys because they were there together. I mean, it doesn't take you a day to read this report and all of the content that he covers in this. So there's no doubt in my mind he covered almost all this content with them while they were working so that they could understand this. But for whatever reason, as the other states came back and rejected, they wanted to have something more formal, and that's exactly what Madison is giving them, is a formal response as to why the judiciary cannot be the final arbiter, because that's what paragraph 23 started off with. But it is objected that the judiciary is to be regarded as the sole expositor regarding the Constitution in all resorts, or in the last resort. Same thing. But anyway, so we're going to dive into paragraph 24, and actually, I'm going to have Sean do this. And Sean, so almost all of this is just hot stuff. So as you read through this, when you see a semicolon, then, or, you know, let's go through, let me see, let's read the 4 lines on page 5, and then on our page 4, and then on page 5, let's go down to where it ends on the second line before it ends of the department and starts a new sentence, but the proper answer. Let's start with that first part, and then we'll get into the but the proper answer as he goes into it further. So let's do those 6 lines. Go ahead.
On this objection, it might be observed first that there may be instances of usurped power, which the forms of the Constitution would never draw within control of the judicial department. Secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary be raised above the authority of the sovereign parties to the Constitution, decisions of the other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative and final with the decisions of that department. But the proper answer objection is...
So that's where that we can stop. We can stop right there. So... And I appreciate the pause. So what he basically lays out is that the basic objection is that they're supposed to do this. However, he says there may be instances of usurped power, which in the forms of the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. So what does he mean by that? He's talking about the limitations of the Constitution itself. In other words, the other departments, these usurpations of power, are outside those things that arise under the Constitution. So a good case in point, something that arises under the Constitution is calling forth the militia. A usurpation of power regarding the militia would be the Dick Act, which means that they're actually playing with something that they have power to, but they're doing it in a way that actually takes the states, and it defies the states' roles and responsibilities in the Constitution. When you read the Dick Act, it wipes out the states' involvement of training and everything else. It basically, the federal government assumes full control over the militia, with keeping that militia there in the Constitution. They never get rid of it, but here's where they, you know, because as the Constitution identifies that they have the power to call forth the militia, and they have the role and responsibility to both and power to equip, train, discipline, and so forth, and then work with the states and their training and the assignment of officers, the Dick Act completely bypassed the states and said, we're going to take full control. Fundamentally, when you look at the Air Guard and the National Guard, the states really don't have any control anymore over officers and the training, because the training's all been consolidated, right? So, I mean, if you're going to be in artillery in the Army, where would you go, Sean?
Or Sill.
Fort Sill in Oklahoma. So in other words, there's not going to be any training in your state where the Constitution basically says the training will be done by the states. So the what he's trying to deduce here or lay out is that there may be usurpations within the Constitution. However, there may be usurpations that are completely outside of that, like the assumption of parks and recreations and creating these national forests. Those things aren't even enumerated, which means that, hold on here. Now, there's no way the judiciary can be involved in those things. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's what he's alluding to here. He's basically saying that the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department because it doesn't arise under the judicial department or under this Constitution. In other words, it's well outside their jurisdiction. The ratification debates were clear, and as a matter of fact, it was stated several times that their jurisdiction was based, the federal jurisdiction, not just the federal court, all federal branches, their jurisdiction was limited to those things within the Constitution. Okay, so secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary is raised above the authority of the sovereign parties, then the decisions of other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative. In other words, if one branch of power, or one branch of government, can assume power beyond themselves, then that basically means that the president as well as the executive can do the same thing. But here's the real proper answer, and that's what you're going to get into. So go ahead now. But the proper answer to the objection.
My please, where would I?
It's the second, the end of the second line, I think. Actually, you know what? It's probably off because I added something. So it's probably the beginning of the top line or towards the very, you know, it, anyway, but the proper answer to the objection is, I realized that I actually wrote a line in here that kind of took my page off.
Right. We're not looking at the same thing.
Yeah. A little, it's a little bit different. So anyway, if you really look at the, because the font's the same, if you go to the sixth line of this paragraph, at the end of that line, it starts with, but the proper answer
the objection is,
there you go,
that the resolution of the General Assembly relates to those great and extraordinary cases in which all the forms of the Constitution may prove ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it. The resolution supposes that dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by other departments, but that the judicial department also may exercise or sanction dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution, and consequently that the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether the compact has been dangerously violated must extend to violations by one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary as well as by the executive or the legislature.
Okay, so in this particular case, we're talking about the Alien Sedition Acts. And Madison and Jefferson have kind of leaped off or leaped into this, you know, head first, saying we have to take a stand because this is directly affecting the privileges or the rights of the people. And so we need to take a stand because everything else can degenerate from this point right here. Madison is bringing up these other cases, and unfortunately, he didn't have the history like we have today of how many different things like the militia that I've already brought up or the assumptions of other powers. Like, I'll give you another one, the assuming the power over energy and being able to regulate energy and coming up with a national strategy on energy when the federal government has literally created a brokerage and agreement with the cartels of OPEC and all of the energy powers, global energy corporations and nations and states to basically sell America downstream. So it's been proven that if there comes any point in time where a vehicle can threaten the consumption of oil, gasoline or what have you, then those vehicles are kept in check. Now, there had been a concerted effort over the past couple of decades of shifting, but they still protect the oil industry because now there's so many cars that they can actually start creating an internal competition of fossil fuel cars as well as combustion engine, or not combustion, electrical. And so they're now basically trying to mandate the only other car that can come in. They're keeping, and as a matter of fact, if a car company successfully deploys hydrogen, the only reason it is being deployed is because it is favorable by the world. In other words, those world corporations and those who are in control. In other words, our government is not dictating what's best for us. Our government is colluding with the world and dictating what the world agrees that we should have. Does that make sense? And
yes, sir.
I don't know how much more dangerous these types of infractions can really, I mean, if you really start understanding this, folks, it means that we're no longer even their concern. And they're doing this out in the open. This is why he says, in which all the forms of the Constitution may prove ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it. So that's where you left off. So go ahead and pick up from there. The resolution supposes?
The resolution supposes.
Oh, you know what? So actually, no, you actually went through that.
No,
so
I'm on 25.
Well, so no, you're not. Are you? No, you're actually. Did you read the whole thing? Okay,
yes, so my I did. Bad. I read.
Okay, good.
Then the last line of 24.
Okay, then let me cover this last one, because consequently, this is what Madison says. Consequently, that the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether the compact has been dangerously violated must extend to violations by one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary, the executive, and/or the legislature. So, in other words, if the legislature wants to start creating laws, or if the executive wants to perform, like go to war, then the states actually have the responsibility of making sure that the executive doesn't become that type of tyrant. If the rest of the branches of the federal government do nothing, the states must. And he's basically kind of alluding to this fact that if one does it, then the others will do it. And so, therefore, you know, we can't just let one get away with it. And that's one of the justifications. He actually goes into another one. In paragraph 25 is where he goes into this. So 25 goes, however true, go ahead.
However true, therefore, it may be that the judicial department is, in all questions submitted to it by the forms of the Constitution, to decide in last resort. This resort must necessarily be deemed the last in relation to the authorities of the other departments of the government.
Okay.
Not in relation.
Okay, so right there, he's basically saying that they have the ability to make the final decision in relationship to the federal government. But what if the parties, the states themselves, look at the determination and say, hold on here, where the federal government has actually taken upon itself these privileges and or these powers and usurpations that exceed the boundaries of the Constitution, then that's when the states actually can come in, even though it may be within the Constitution itself. But it may be giving them the ability to judge, like the Militia Act, and say, well, it's within the Constitution, and the judiciary basically rules in favor of it because they have the power, because it arises under the Constitution. That's making sense, right? So they've created the Dick Act because that clearly is an enumerated power that they can regulate the militia, but they regulated it in such a way that they've basically taken away all powers from the states, where in Article 1, Section 8, the states actually have protected powers, and they say we're not going to honor that anymore. The states at that point in time, even though the judiciary can rule because it does arise under the Constitution and it benefits the federal government, the states still have the ability to step in and say not. And that's what he gets into moving forward. So basically the carrying it forward, not in relation to the rights of the parties. Go ahead, let that part.
Not in relation to the rights of the parties to the Constitutional Compact, from which the judicial as well as the other departments hold their delegated trust. On any other hypothesis, the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it, and the concurrence of this department with the others in usurped powers might subvert forever and beyond the possible reach of any rightful remedy the very Constitution which all were instituted to preserve.
Right. So right there, he's basically saying the bottom line, if the judiciary crosses that line and says, you know, this is legitimate, this Dick Act, and that the federal government now has full control over the militias, then what ends up happening is the states can step in and say, no, we're the parties to this. And it basically goes like this, folks, if I could break this down as simple as a simpleton like myself can. The states would look at this and go, look, we created this government and we created this very specific delegated power with these very specific functions the way we did to preserve what we believe is essential to the union as well as our sovereignty. And we view what you're doing that is a violation to this cannot stand. That you've ruled in favor of it, even, and because it arises under the Constitution, you've had your shot in trying to actually correct this constitutionally, but you've ruled in favor, and we can't let that go. Because in essence, it is destroying our sovereignty and our control over our militia. And the intent and context to how the militia is to serve the Union as well as the states has just been trampled on by your ruling. Is that simple enough?
Yes, sir. And I would question you as to whether or not we are at that point now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because, like he's saying, if we allow you to overrule this and do things that are unconstitutional and say that they have the power to do it, even though it's not in the Constitution, then they can eventually just get rid of the Constitution. Because if you don't have the power to stop them from doing this in this instance, then what's to stop them from doing anything that they decide to do?
Well, so the states always have that power because it's their constitution. And as a matter of fact, one would think that when the federal government lays out hints that we're getting rid of the Constitution because it's holding us back from doing what we really need to do to get, you know, to move forward as a global government, because we have failed by our debt and everything else, we need to step into the next new level of governing as a global government. In other words, the corporations take over. The corporations, banks, and the globalists take over. So... I've been haranguing on the militia, but I'll give you another good case in point. The Constitution, what arises under the Constitution regarding the regulation of commerce, is that the federal government will have the power, Congress will have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and regulate commerce among the states and with Indian tribes. And the regulating commerce among the states has been usurped so badly that they're actually regulating commerce within the states. And so it's to a point where they've created a mercantile system where, you know, free commerce and free, you know, productivity and ideas and all of these other things are not flowing anymore. They've come in and said, nope, you can't make light bulbs that don't make these, you know, incandescent or whatever the regulations just regarding light bulbs that they've wanted to create. So we're going to be going into break in just a minute here, right now. So when we come back, we're going to basically close this out and dive into because actually we just finished reading 25, so we're going to dive into 26. And so when we come back, this is when I think Madison starts kind of summarizing what really needs to happen And bottom line, he lays it out where the authority lies. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now Madison kind of creates this, the next two paragraphs are kind of a summation, because bottom line, because he's made with clarity, I think, why the judiciary can't be the judge of itself or the judge of the creature, in other words, for its own benefit. Because whenever anybody has the ability to judge their own sins, then they will forgive themselves or they will change the law so it's no longer a sin. Madison kind of dives into the fundamentals once again. So this is where he kind of pulls everything back into, you know, how he's kind of started this argument. So go ahead and let's dive into this, because, and actually, let me read the first black line, or the first section of this. It's all black text. The truth declared in the resolution being established. The expediency of making the declaration at the present day may safely be left to the temperate consideration and candid judgment of the American people. In other words, the fact that we actually created this declaration by these resolutions should be basically left to the public to decide what the heck's going on and what, you know, whether this is important or not, instead of, you know, allowing this to linger because the other states have now failed to do their job. The other states have basically subjugated themselves to the federal government, which is Madison basically, you know, highlighted in these last couple of paragraphs. So this is where he kind of goes through, you know, you got to remember that this is all fundamental tenets of contract law. These are the basic principles that we all understand and these basic doctrines. And then he wraps it up with, you know, this whole concept and relationship between the Constitution authority that is in the Constitution to the government and the people and so forth. So I'll let you go ahead and read the rest of this. And, you know, because it's kind of a conclusion, go ahead and read the whole thing.
It will be remembered that a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is solemnly enjoined by most of the state constitutions, and particularly by our own, as a necessary safeguard against the danger of degeneracy to which republics are liable, as well as other governments, though in a less degree than others. And a fair comparison of the political doctrines not unfrequent at the present day with those which characterize the epoch of our revolution and which form the basis of our republican constitutions will best determine whether the declaratory recurrence here made to those principles ought to be viewed as unseasonable and improper, or as a vigilant discharge of an important duty. The authority of constitutions over governments and of the sovereignty of the people over constitutions are truths which are at all times necessary to be kept in mind, and at no time perhaps more necessary than at present.
It's my opinion that on that last line, that we're dealing with far more critical issues, and it is far more apparent and necessary that we be mindful and we actually start living this concept that we have to hold our government accountable to our constitutions, as he rounded it up, the authority of constitutions over governments and the sovereignty of the people over constitutions are the truths at all times necessary to be kept in mind. But even before this, he talks about these basic tenets, this idea that these, you know, as we created this republican form of government, that there's going to be this relationship between the sovereignty of the states to this federal government. That when the states joined the union, they joined in a resolve to not just create a union to benefit them, but they also created a union that they would have to guard against. This was clearly brought up in the ratification debates, that it would not be sufficient to basically just think that the federal government is going to stay in check. This is why they basically said that the states would need to create measures that would actually help contain the federal government, as well as measures amongst the states to actually work together to keep that federal government in check. And so Madison, you know, one thing I've garnered out of this whole document over the past few years is this concept that when a state joins the union, they're joining and committing to the fellow states that they will support and defend this Constitution, not just become, you know, a benefactor of receiving benefits by being in the union, but this concept, and this goes to even the responsibility of a citizen, and it goes to the core of this entire structure, this framework of government, self-government that we have. This is why I made this conclusion. This is why this epiphany came to me. That when you look at this government is like a body, like a human body, that every component is integral in ensuring that this Constitution be constantly refreshed and enforced, to be overlooked, or I should say not overlooked, but to be overviewed or you know, watched over diligently and vigilantly to ensure that whenever things go awry, that the immune system kicks in, that the immune system gets these foreign things that government's not supposed to be doing and purge them from its body, just like the human body. When a nail is permeated or a virus starts, proliferating through the body, the body's immune system starts attacking those things to get rid of it. That means that the primary function when the immune system kicks in is our public servants. They are the first line of defense in attacking this. And when necessary, it will basically go to, you know, all the bodies of the government itself, which is we the people. As it breaks down from the federal to the states to the counties, and we the people. So in other words, as we kind of look at, you know, this government, I view this very similar to the human body. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir, it does.
And so I think when we look at it that way, it helps us understand the importance of this immune system and the function of the immune system and the responsibility of all of the components. Because bottom line, if our first line of defense is failing us, then what do? We either replace them or we start forcing them to behave. And so that's what we have to do. So the 27th paragraph, which is the very last paragraph, let's go ahead and read this one.
These observations appear to form a satisfactory reply to every objection which is not founded on a misconception of the terms employed in the resolutions. There is one other, however, which may be of too much importance not to be added. It cannot be forgotten that among the arguments addressed to those who apprehended danger to liberty from the establishment of the general government over so great a country, the appeal was emphatically made to the intermediate existence of the state governments between the people and that government, to the vigilance with which they would descry the first symptoms of usurpation. and to the promptitude with which they would sound the alarm to the public. This argument was probably not without its effect, and if it was a proper one then to recommend the establishment of a constitution, it must be a proper one now to assist in its interpretation.
Interesting. So it's kind of like what I just said, that when we look at what's going on and our first line of defense is failing, but see, what he's saying here is that the first line of defense is to basically, you know, sound the alarm to warn everybody, hey, we need your support. And unfortunately, we trusted these guys and they didn't do that. And so when they started selling us out for the Ponzi scheme of the, you know, the sale of public lands, all these little things that they started doing that they shouldn't have been doing, so that they all could get, you know, a little rich and a little something, something on the side there, they were selling us out. So anything else, any other contributions or thoughts you might have regarding this?
No, sir. Okay. I think he pretty much said it all.
Okay, well, thank you. So where we are now, folks, is we're going to dive into the next and final document of the five, which is Madison's notes on nullification. And so let's go ahead and actually, crap, I think I already have them open here. So, Sean, do you have them open? Probably
yes,
not.
Sir.
Oh, you got the notes on nullification. All right. Let's go ahead and dive into those at this point. And so actually, let me give you the background on this, folks, instead of just diving in. I apologize. Where's my head? So this is in 1800. And in 1800, as Madison and Jefferson made these final comments in the resolution of this right here, Madison basically was kind of saying that, you know, we can't allow this to happen. So what is our other option? He basically said it in the report, that we now have to appeal to the people. If we can't get them to do what they're supposed to do, we need to appeal to the people. And so that's exactly what him and Jefferson did. They used the Republican Party to make an appeal that in the next election, we vote in new people. They were able to come forward with a brand new party because at that point in time, there weren't these restrictions on parties to bring forward new people. Folks, you've heard me go through this with Gerald Wistrand when we talk about the laws that the states have made to restrict new parties. I mean, you just can't come in with a bunch of candidates. You have to have money. You actually have to get signatures. You can't just put people on the ballot. And it's interesting if everything was within the state realm, but it's not. The Constitution creates the parameters of restrictions for representatives and senators. Does it say that you have to be a party member in the Constitution to be able to get your name on the ballot?
Nope.
No, but the states are creating laws that basically favor the party so that you don't need, as long as you go with the two parties, then your name's going to go on the ballot. But if you're coming up as a third party or independent or what have you, you can't put your name on the ballot without a certain amount of signatures. The Constitution doesn't allow that. So for a representative that wants to actually, you know, hey, I don't want to be affiliated in any party. Now, Madison and Jefferson proved that if you create a party, you can actually create a narrative, a platform, whatever you want to call it, so that everybody understands what all these people, if I vote Republican, they stand for this, and I want to vote Republican. So they obviously used a party to do this. But the point is that the states have now created protective measures to keep anybody from ever doing an end run around the uniparty and actually seizing their power. And if you don't see it that way, then you really need to back up more and more and more until you finally see the big picture. Because at this point in time, folks, because they have such a monopoly, it becomes the primary problem. And the only way we're going to get through this is a big part of this is actually starting with the counties and taking over, either taking over the Republican Party, or basically by the time we get up to the state level, we have to rewrite that constitution and remove those types of laws to ensure that there's no more control over any person being able to go into a political office. So what? There's 100 people's names for president, or I should say for elector, but there wouldn't be. Actually, if we did this properly, most of those problems really wouldn't be as big of a problem as you think they are at all. Anyway, I digress. So Madison and Jefferson successfully created this coup. They took over, and they lived happily ever after for at least 6 terms, and I mean that by 2 terms of Jefferson, 2 terms of Madison, and then 2 terms of James Monroe, and then 1 term of John Quincy Adams. If you actually go look at John Quincy Adams' party affiliation, and actually if you look at the party affiliations by Wiki, they basically tell you that this was the Democratic Republican Party. In this document, Madison comes right out and says, we created the Republican Party. And there's going to be an instance towards the very first part of this, so we may actually uncover it today, and I will go, aha, there it is. And as a matter of fact, when you look at this document, when you download it and look at it, I believe you'll find the Republican Party jumps out in blue, and it first time shows up on the 4th page. So maybe we won't get to it today. But nevertheless, this document was created in 1834. After Madison and Jefferson did what they did, John C. Calhoun came up with this idea that a single state could ignore or nullify federal law. Just ignore it. That's not nullifying the law. What is nullifying the law, Sean?
Eviscerating it.
Yes, removing it from the books. It no longer exists. That is a nullified law. So when the law sits out there and it affects everybody but you, Madison points out that this is going to create a level of chaos in the Union, especially if states can just cherry pick what laws they want to follow. Bottom line, the marriage or the commitment to the Union is that we would abide by all laws of the federal government, but we would also hold that federal government accountable to the laws it creates, to the Constitution. Hold them accountable to the Constitution for those laws that they create, so forth and so on. So anyway, so as John C. Calhoun went down this, he created this elaborate scheme that for a single state not to, you know, nullify a law, it would require, I think he put it in here, 3/4 of the states to basically, you know, say, hey, you can't nullify. And so, in other words, this is what we're going to start off with paragraph 3. So let's go ahead and jump into paragraph 3. And I think, this concept of single state nullification started popping up in 1828. 20 years later? Yeah. 20 years later? No, 30 years later.
30, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's pick up with paragraph 3.
The forbidding aspect of a naked creed according to which a process instituted by a single state is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority of 7 over a majority of 17 has led its partisans to disguise its deformity under the position that a single state may rightfully resist an unconstitutional and tyrannical law of the United States, keeping out of view the essential distinction between a constitutional right and the natural and universal right of resisting intolerable oppression. But the true question is whether a single state has a constitutional right to annul or suspend the operation of a law of the United States within its limits, the state remaining a member of the Union and admitting the Constitution to be in force.
Right. In other words, it creates a hypocrisy. It creates chaos and so forth. So let's keep going.
With the like policy, the nullifiers pass over the state of things at the date of the proceedings of Virginia and the particular doctrines and arguments to which they were opposed, without an attention to which the proceedings in this case, as in other cases, may be insecure against a perverted construction.
Okay, so if you didn't notice, Mads is putting a spin on this. And as a matter of fact, out of all the documents I ever saw this man write, you can tell this is a personal document because he definitely puts this derogatory labeling on these people who are, they're calling themselves nullifiers, but they're not nullifying. They're ignorant, or they're ignorites, if you want to come up with a word, because bottom line, all they're doing is ignoring the law. They're not nullifying it. They're just saying, okay, they created a law. We're going to ignore it. Does that fix the problem? No. The problem will still persist. What the federal government is doing will continue. And bottom line, as states start to single state nullify, one, it'll create chaos. It'll start pitting states against each other to say, you know, okay, well, we don't like what you're nullifying, but we're going to nullify this. What we have to do is we have to hold the government fully accountable. The problem is, and this is the question, and I'm going to probably say this several times before the end of the year. As adults, are we adult enough to say we're no longer going to take these stipends? We're no longer going to allow ourselves to be dependent on the federal government to giving us money, printing money, inflating us, inflating our currency, stealing our property? Because those are all the things that they're doing when they inflate our currency. So will we be mature enough, we mature adults, will we actually behave in such a way that we don't allow the federal government to bribe us anymore, that we basically turn our backs on what they're doing, what they're giving us, and those types of things? That's the real question, folks, because we, the people, have to determine and decide. The states actually have the final say and the final authority. And what I will say on top of this is that when we look at Social Security, those types of, you know, albatrosses that we're just strapped with, those types of things don't have to end, but the states have to deal with them to end them, but without ending them as far as the benefits of paying out those people who are in a position where they've already crossed that line. They shouldn't be hurt because they believe this big lie that their government has been telling them for years and years and years, for generations. So that's one of those things that I agree with Milton Friedman, that when we start dismantling things, we need to shut down the Social Security, but we don't dismantle it. We either learn and figure out whether we can transition it to the states and allow the states to basically collect those taxes and take care of those people within their states, what have you, and end that program altogether so that the next generations, as they start coming up, will no longer be strapped with that albatross. Okay, so let's go into the next paragraph, paragraph 5.
But don't you think there should be a way to hold the people accountable who have benefited the most from these unconstitutional overreaches to remedy the situation like you were talking about?
Okay, so what we're talking about, and I think what you're talking about, and I'm just going to go ahead and mute you because I'm getting a little feedback, so I'll unmute you when I stop talking. Okay, so there's Congress that has created their own private retirement system that they have no constitutional authority to have. That needs to end and completely gone. And as a matter of fact, if they're going to get anything, they'll get it from the Social Security. All the money that they have put away in whatever coffers, whatever that trust fund, or if they really believe that they're just printing money off of the Treasury, then maybe they won't get anything. Bottom line is, those types of things where people are benefiting at the expense of others, that's got to end. But more importantly, getting things right doesn't mean justice can't be served. I believe that there'll be plenty of people, because right now there's more than enough people that want justice. In other words, there's more people that want to see perp walks than actually end the tyranny. People love the idea of DOGE, but it didn't end the tyranny. We're shutting down the spending. Well, it didn't completely shut things down. So when I look at, you know, the possibility of justice, there's no doubt in my mind, there is an abundance of people out there that are willing and want and demand people to do perp walks and have and obtain their justice, as well as there, it's undeniable that there has been money stolen at the hands of government corporations, these raiders, bankers, all sorts of people that have done wrong and so forth. I think is more than enough out there that will be able to guide most all of this. The real question that I leave to everybody is, how many pounds of flesh do we want to, you know, scrape off the carcass, or do we literally keep the carcass in, you know, in hold, so that when it grows more, we can take more off of it? If that makes sense, does that make sense?
Well, you're right, exactly. I agree with what you're saying about the pound of flesh thing. I'm not even talking about a pound of flesh. What I'm talking about is taking these people's fortunes that they have built, using off the backs of the people, and by robbing us and weakening our economy by just siphoning all our labor from us. Uh-huh. Shouldn't that be used to remedy the situations like you were talking about? Social Security, you got people that are on generational welfare that need job training. We need, you know, things like that. I'm talking about the real costs within the economy.
Yeah, so these corporations are right now being protected by the federal government. Once the federal government can't regulate every corporation that's going to operate or sell products in a state that's not being produced in a state, i.e. foreign, then it's got to be viewed as foreign trade, foreign commerce. I mean, this is not a simple question. You're asking a very difficult question to kind of go through all these different cases of what about in this case, what about in this case, in this case, in this case. The reality is we have to terminate these government controls and these government powers and restore them back to the states. In that process, and as a matter of fact, if you look at the Republic review process, the terminations aren't going to be immediate. But the most important thing, when the states in Republic review basically send forward the edict that you're going to shut, the directive, that you will shut down the Department of Education, with that will be appointed either a body of people that will go in, you know, a couple from each state or what have you, because you've got the state in this tribunal. Let's say you have 24, 25, not 24. It'd have to be 26 or more, because you have to have 26 states. We're running out of time. But what we need to do is start talking about the directives and all of that with Republic Review in our next, so we can kind of go through and answer that question. Because the states will have the ability to actually go in and start seizing and capturing all the data. But I think it's important that we, you know, bring this forward for tomorrow's episode, or actually for Monday's episode. Thank you so much, Sean. Unfortunately, again, that was a great question. It's just there's so many, you know, what ifs and therefores. So anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.